The topic of today's lecture is science and technology, though I'll be focusing mainly on science. That's because the previous lecture already dealt with civil engineering, and the next lecture will deal with technology applied to medicine. Damn clever chappies, the Greeks. To start off, let me give you an example of Greek scientific know-how which attracted the attention of the national media in 2006. In 1900, a sponge diver named Elias Staviatos discovered the wreckage of a cargo boat that had sunk in 65 BC just off the coast of Antikythera in the Aegean. Many statues and other objects were recovered from the wreck, including a calcium-encrusted bronze object consisting of cogs, wheels, and dials. The object was just over a foot high and has been likened in appearance to a clock that you might set on a mantelpiece. Scientists had been asking themselves what the heck the object was for over a century, and it was only in 2006, thanks to X-ray tomography and high-resolution scanning, that the mystery was finally solved. Tomography, from the Greek tomos, meaning a section or cutting, is the process of obtaining an image in the form of sections. An Anglo-Greek team that investigated the bronze object concluded that it was a kind of ancient computer used to map the motions of the sun, the moon, and the planets. It could also predict eclipses and even chart the irregular orbit of the moon. In the words of Michael Wright, former curator of the Science Museum in London, the skill with which it was made shows a level of instrument making not surpassed until the Renaissance. The Antikythera mechanism, as the device is known, proves that by the 1st century BC, the Greeks were producing highly complicated miniature mechanisms of a complexity that was not to be equaled for another 1,000 years. To quote Mike Edmonds, one of the scientists who cracked the code, so to speak, in terms of historic and scarcity value, it's more valuable than the Mona Lisa. Well, who says scientists can't get passionate? And it's probably, incidentally, due to the intervention of the Romans that it has survived. That's because the Antikythera mechanism, along with other objects on board the same ship, were probably looted from Rhodes in order to feature in one of Julius Caesar's triumphs. Rhodes aroused Caesar's anger because it sided with Pompey in the Civil War. There was an important school of philosophy on Rhodes, and it seems too that many important scientists worked there, including Posidonius, whom we'll be talking about later. Or paradoxically, had the object actually reached Rome, it might well have been melted down and lost for posterity. So the Antikythera mechanism serves as a valuable object lesson in the contrasting Greek and Roman attitudes towards what we might call pure science. If we've heard of one Greek scientist, then it's probably Archimedes, approximate dates 287 to 212 BC. What we all probably know best about him is the anecdote which the Roman architect named Vitruvius reports in his treatise on architecture. Vitruvius tells us that Archimedes discovered his famous principle of buoyancy while lying in a tub in a public bathhouse. After solving the problem, he jumped out of the tub, neglecting to cover himself in his robe, and ran down the street naked, shouting out, "Eureka! Eureka! I found it! I found it!" Archimedes was the original mad scientist, or so the anecdote suggests. Plutarch, in his Life of Marcellus, tells us that he got so absorbed in geometry that he neglected to eat and drink. Archimedes was a prolific writer, though little of his work has survived. However, at least 7 of his treatises are preserved on a manuscript known as the Archimedes Palimpsest. A palimpsest is a parchment or some other writing material that has been used a second time after the original writing has been scraped off in the interests of economy. The word derives from the Greek palimpsestos, meaning literally scraped again. Palimpsests were common in the Middle Ages because parchment was expensive. The treatises by Archimedes were written in the 10th century and then erased shortly before 1229 to make way for a prayer book. Of special interest is the one entitled On Floating Bodies, which only survives in this palimpsest and which contains the famous law, any solid lighter than a fluid will, if placed in the fluid, be immersed so far that the weight of the solid will be equal to the weight of the fluid dispersed. There's an interesting follow-up to the story of Archimedes, who you'll recall died in the siege of Syracuse by the Romans in 211 BC, while resisting arrest. He wanted to finish the problem he was working on first. In the Tusculan Disputations, Cicero tells us that in 74 BC, when he was a young man, he went looking for Archimedes' tomb in Syracuse. It was completely overgrown with brambles and thorns, as the locals knew nothing about it. When he'd had it cleaned up, he was able to read the inscription, which verified that it was indeed the tomb of Archimedes. It's a rather moving Roman tribute to a Greek. Good for Cicero, though he characteristically adds in his self-absorbed way. One of the most famous cities in the Greek-speaking world would have remained ignorant of the tomb of its most brilliant citizen had not a man from Arpinum come and pointed it out. The man from Arpinum being, of course, Cicero. We've already discussed Virgil's famous passage of national self-definition, in which he implicitly contrasts the Romans with the Greeks, listing all the things that the Greeks would dab hands at, and then stating, rather magisterially, that the Roman job was to rule the world. Among the interests that he attributed to the Greeks was a bent for astronomy. Let others, he wrote, mark out with an astronomer's staff the paths of the heavens and describe the risings of the stars. Astronomy was, in fact, merely one of many branches of science in which the Greeks excelled. Our word science actually comes from the Latin word scientia, meaning knowledge in general. There was no word in either Latin or Greek that did duty for our concept of science. Science was a subdivision of philosophia, and philosophia meant intellectual inquiry in general. To the extent that the ancients conceived of science as a distinctive branch of philosophy, they tended to think of it in its discrete entities rather than as a totalizing concept. Most of the branches of science that we recognize today had already been identified by the Greeks, including mathematics, geometry, physics, astronomy, geography, anatomy, biology, botany, pharmacology, gynecology, optics, physiology, and zoology. What the ancients did not develop were what we call today the social sciences, although we could argue that they made some limited headway. The Greek historian Herodotus, for instance, displays an understanding of the principles of both ethnography and anthropology. Neither of these two disciplines was, however, identified as something separate from history. Nor did the ancients identify psychology or sociology or economics as independent subjects of inquiry. Political science, however, was on their radar, being a major topic of interest for both Plato, particularly in the Republic and in the Laws, and for Aristotle, particularly in the Politics. To understand the place of science in ancient society, it'll be helpful to enumerate some of the differences in how it was perceived and practiced then and now. First, there were many more competing scientific ideas in the ancient world at any one time than there are in the modern world. Most people tend to think that Einstein got it right and that there is a direct intellectual trajectory from Newton to Einstein. There was no such trajectory in antiquity. Even though certain scientific ideas prevailed over others, those others still continued to exist. And a lot would have depended on just how persuasive the holder of a new scientific idea was, how effectively he wrote, pretty well all scientists were men, and how cogently he argued his case in public. Second, science was not separated from ethical and religious considerations. There was no hard and fast divide between astronomy and astrology, for starters. Ptolemy of Alexandria, considered the greatest astronomer of late antiquity, was totally convinced of the predictive power of astrology. In his view, and in that of many other scientists, astronomy and astrology were the same discipline. Third, there was nothing comparable to a science laboratory, and such collections of specimens as existed were owned privately. Though Alexandria was indisputably a centre for scientific inquiry, its library and museum were primarily devoted to philology and literary criticism. Science, as we understand the term, in all its manifest variety, was unquestionably more Greek than Roman. It was the Greeks who first introduced the idea of natural proof. It was the Greeks who first sought to classify natural phenomena and make connections between them. And it was the Greeks who first introduced the idea of natural causality, thereby removing the divine from the equation. However, and this is very important, the Greeks were not the only or the first Mediterranean people to be interested in science. There was an especially close connection between Babylonian and Greek astronomy from the 4th century BC onwards, and Greek astronomers undoubtedly drew on Babylonian data. There are two other important points to be borne in mind. One, Greek scientists continued to do important work under Roman rule, even though the heyday of science was in the Hellenistic period. And two, though they were not particularly inventive, the Romans did produce a number of invaluable compilations of natural history and other subjects. They include Varro, 1st century BC, whose writings covered every branch of learning under the sun. Celsus, early 1st century AD, who wrote a compendium on agriculture and medicine, as well as on military tactics and rhetoric. And Pliny the Elder, Celsus's younger contemporary, whose natural history constitutes the world's first encyclopedia. The different attitude to science manifested by the Greeks and the Romans is one of the most striking differences between the two peoples. So what was this due to? Well, two possible explanations are put forward. Number one is the persistent stereotype explanation, so to speak. It goes like this. The Greeks were a highly inventive people, fascinated with discovery, whereas the Romans were bound by tradition and distrustful of things newfangled. We could go further and say that the Greeks were fascinated by speculative investigation, whereas the Romans had little time for open-ended questions. Questions for them had to have answers, answers that had some practical benefit, which is why they were interested in the applications of science. Explanation number two involves the contrasting socio-political conditions among the Greeks and Romans. Roman society was more hierarchically structured, and the Romans as a people were inherently more conservative and traditionalist than the Greeks. Probably both explanations should be factored in, though, as I've noted, we should not think of the attitudes of the two peoples as wholly antithetical. So how did you become a scientist in the ancient world? Science was not much on the school curriculum in either Greece or Rome, nor does there seem to have been much emphasis on even mathematics at what we would call either the elementary or high school level. It was, however, taught at the tertiary level. Above the door of Plato's academy ran the stern warning, Agiometretos medes aesito. Let no one enter who is ignorant of geometry. Science, unlike philosophy, was not a highly paid profession in the sense that scientists could go on the highly profitable lecture circuit. This means that many of the most eminent scientists would either have been men of independent means or else have earned their living some other way. some important asides. There were no symbols for mathematical operations, no plus or minus signs, and no multiplication or division signs either. The decimal point had not been invented, but a sign for zero turns up in astronomical papyri. The Greeks used the letters of the alphabet for numbers, the letter alpha for one, beta for two, gamma for three, and so on down the alphabet. The Roman system, by contrast, was far more economical. The letter I for numbers between 1 to 4, 6 to 9, etc. V for 5, X for 10, L for 50, and so on. Both the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians before them used an abacus or counting board. It was Euclid, a possible date when he flourished, 300 BC, who wrote the first extant mathematical treatise. He called it Stoicheia, which is translated Elements, and it was so called because it was intended to offer a foundation course in mathematics. Euclid's book was partly a compilation of earlier work, but what he did was to provide irrefutable proofs to all the mathematical theorems proposed by his predecessors. It was so comprehensive that it wasn't until the middle of the 19th century that what we call post-Euclidean geometry evolved. As I mentioned earlier, the Greeks made contributions to a wide variety of scientific disciplines. What I'm going to focus upon now is the one where their achievement was particularly stellar, if you'll forgive the pun, namely astronomy. I'm just going to say a little about some of the greatest Greek scientists, though we shouldn't assume that they were working in complete isolation from one another. Their discoveries no doubt depended in part on those of others whose names have not been preserved. The first Greek astronomer, both first and astronomer are in quotes, of whom we have record was Thales of Miletus. He's best known for the claim that he predicted a solar eclipse that occurred on May the 28th, 585 BC. Whether this is true is another matter altogether. It was the sense of order that scientists detected in the organization of the heavens that contributed to the absence of a division between astronomy and astrology. The greatest work demonstrating this proposition is Aristotle's On the Heavens. It's in that work that Aristotle indicates that the Earth is spherical, basing his argument in part on the shape of the Earth's shadow at the occurrence of a lunar eclipse. Heraclides of Pontus, 387 to 312 BC, was the first scientist to propose that the Earth rotates on its axis once a day, and thus the first to explain the separation of day from night. Aristarchus of Samos, who lived in the early 3rd century, is sometimes known as the Copernicus of antiquity, because he was the first to propose that the sun is at the center of the universe, the heliocentric or sun-centered system from the Greek word helios, meaning sun. However, his successors, including the great Ptolemy of Alexandria, whom I mentioned a moment ago, all rejected his hypothesis, largely because they couldn't accept the necessary corollary, namely that the Earth was just one among hundreds, from their perspective, of stars placed arbitrarily in the heavens. The only known astronomer who did accept Aristarchus's heliocentric hypothesis was a Babylonian named Seleucus, around 150 BC. Next, Eratosthenes of Cyrene, 275 to 194, a librarian in Alexandria who worked out the Earth's circumference by the use of nothing more complicated than a stick. Poor old Eratosthenes. He was nicknamed Beta. That's because he was a polymath, yet always he was second best at everything. You've got a feel for the guy. He was actually impressively accurate in his measurement of the circumference of the Earth, which he estimated to be about 24,000 miles. I say about because we don't know the exact length of the measure he was using. but it's likely that his margin of error was as low as 2.5%. Later Greek scientists, including Ptolemy, calculated that the Earth's circumference was considerably smaller, around 20,000 miles. The Ptolemaic figure was the one that was believed in the 15th century, and it's sometimes alleged that had Christopher Columbus known the true size that was larger, he might never have set out on his voyage of discovery. Hipparchus of Nicaea, who flourished around 135 BC, proposed a theory of the motions of the sun and the moon, although he rejected Aristarchus's heliocentric theory. Hipparchus also discovered the precession of the equinoxes. That's to say, he discovered how the points of the equinox move along a particular track followed by the Earth in orbit, and how they return to the same place in the track in the course of 26,000 years. As I said earlier, damn clever chappies, the Greeks. According to tradition, astrological law was introduced into Rome by a Greek slave named Antiochus in the 2nd century BC. It took an instant hold over the public. Indeed, astrology took such a firm grip over the Roman imagination that the Senate became paranoid and suspected that its practitioners were undermining the moral fabric of the state. So, in 139 BC, it passed a decree expelling all astrologers from Rome. It was, however, fighting a losing battle, as the conservatives were in so many other areas of Greek influence. It was largely due to a Greek philosopher called Posidonius, approximate dates 135 to 51 BC, who taught on the island of Rhodes, that astrology entered the mainstream of Roman culture. Posidonius was an extremely prolific writer who wrote about every branch of science from anthropology to zoology. The study of astronomy was to have at least one important effect upon the Romans, notably in the service of efficient administration. By 46 BC, the Roman civic calendar, which was lunar-based and which had a total of only 355 days, had fallen so far out of step with the solar calendar that no fewer than 80 days had to be intercalated to bring it back into line. Julius Caesar, who at the time was Pontifex Maximus, a supreme religious official responsible for the calendar, working in consultation with a Greek astronomer called Sosigenes, instituted what we call today the Julian calendar, based on a year consisting of 365.25 days. And it's the calendar that we use to this day. Moving back to the topic of astrology, some practitioners became important members of the imperial household. One of the most famous was Thrasyllus, who served Tiberius. To test the astrologer's powers, Tiberius once asked him to predict his, Thrasyllus' future. The astrologer replied that he saw that his life was in great danger, which was a pretty accurate reading of Tiberius, if nothing else, since the emperor made it his practice to push those who failed to measure up to his exacting standards from a cliff on the island of Capri. One of the greatest astronomical works of antiquity was the great mathematical syntaxis or treatise, more commonly known as the Almagest, which is the Latinized form of its Arabic title. It's by the Alexandrian Claudius Ptolemaeus, Ptolemy for short, who flourished in the second half of the 2nd century AD. His name is interesting, Claudius being Roman, Ptolemaeus being Greek. Perhaps he had a Roman patron. Almagest is the Arabic transliteration of the Greek he megiste, short for he megiste syntaxis, literally the greatest collection. The Arabs preserved a very great deal of Hellenistic science when they conquered North Africa. Ptolemy's work was based on the geocentric conception of the universe that he took over from Hipparchus of Nicaea. And yet, it superseded all previous work in the field. incorporated all the astronomical phenomena known to date, and became the most important compilation of astronomical data until the 16th century. Interestingly, Ptolemy wrote a complementary treatise, usually translated as Astrological Influences, in which he attempted to integrate astrology with astronomy. There's an important coda to all this which had far-reaching consequences for both science and religion, despite the fact that Aristarchus of Samos had proposed the heliocentric system in the 3rd century BC, it was the geocentric system, the so-called Ptolemaic system, that prevailed in the West. This was largely due to the authority of Aristotle, whose treatise on the heavens was based on the premise that the sun revolved around the earth. And when Aristotle was adopted as the philosopher by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, his writings were revered by the Roman Catholic Church as revealed truth. It wasn't until 1543 that the heliocentric view again began to gain ascendancy, thanks to the work of Copernicus in De Revolutionibus. Another important work of Ptolemy's was his geography, in which he set out to map the entire known world using lines of longitude and latitude to fix the positions of places. We don't actually know whether he produced a map to accompany his book. Those that survive in the manuscripts are of Byzantine date. But one of the principal errors of his work was to make the Mediterranean much more extended in proportion to its width than it is in reality. In the ancient world, technology did not constitute a category that was differentiated from science. There was, in fact, no word for technology, either in Greece or in Latin. Many scientific treatises, such as Ptolemy's Almagest, include what we would regard as technological information, in his particular case, about how to make basic astronomical equipment. Consider, too, the career of Archimedes. Though Archimedes was technologically innovative, he put the practical application of his discoveries on a much lower level than the geometrical calculations on which they were based. On the whole, the technology played a somewhat limited role in the Greco-Roman world, and I think there were at least two reasons for this. The one that is usually cited first and sometimes made to bear full responsibility is that the most arduous and time-consuming physical activities were performed by slaves, thereby reducing the desire for technological innovation. Well, though this was true to some extent, it's difficult to believe that there was no incentive to reduce the size of the workforce, even though modern concepts such as consumer demand and productivity were completely unknown. Another reason of at least equal importance was that practically all mechanical devices were made of wood, and so they had to be constantly replaced because they couldn't tolerate heavy stresses. Energy, moreover, was produced primarily by humans or animals, chiefly donkeys, oxen, and mules. Horses were used for rapid travel, but not much for agricultural work. Most of the goods that were transported across land were conveyed in ox-drawn carts and wagons. Since the top speed of an ox is about 1.5 miles an hour, and the maximum distance that an ox can travel in a day about 11 miles, you get the sense of a rather slow-moving economy. It's also worth noting that, according to Bruce Freer, approximately 60% of the empire's national product derived from agriculture, and that agriculture absorbed about 3/4 of the total workforce. Where technology did play a major part in shaping the Roman world was in the provision of roads, bridges, aqueducts, sewers, and the like, which catered to the needs of literally millions of people. It was through technology that essential services existed in the Roman world, and that is a very great achievement that really has no Greek precedent. One of the earliest inventions was the crane, which the Greeks had at their disposal from the late 6th century BC. The Romans adapted cranes so that they could raise 35 tons or more, thereby enabling them to erect monolithic columns for temples and the like, something the Greeks had never been able to do. Sundials, too, were probably introduced into Greece in the 6th century BC from Babylon, though they didn't become common until the 3rd century BC. One of the most noteworthy inventions is Archimedes' screw, a revolving screw placed around a cylinder. The screw ended in a handle that was rotated by hand. It was used to transfer water from a lower level to a higher level. It's said to have been invented to remove the bilge water from the Syracusia, the largest ship that was ever built in antiquity, capable of carrying 600 passengers. But it came applied to be used in irrigation. Archimedes' screw is, in fact, still used in countries today, especially developing countries. Siege equipment was also important to both the Greeks and the Romans. A notable example is the torsion catapult, first introduced by Philip II of Macedon in the 340s and later adapted by the Romans. For the most part, the Romans improved on machines that had been invented in the Hellenistic period. In the 4th century AD, they developed the so-called onager. The name derives from its kicking action, similar to that of a wild ass or onager, which is what the word literally means. It could be used to hurl large projectiles with considerable force. Another area of striking technological sophistication was glass manufacture. Glass blowing was invented probably in Syria in the 1st century BC. One of the supreme achievements is the so-called Portland vase in the British Museum, dated to the Augustan period. The Portland vase comprises an inner layer of blue glass wrapped in an outer layer of white glass. The white glass has been painstakingly chipped away to reveal a scene of exquisite refinement, alluding to love and loss, though the identity of the figures remains unknown. We know nothing about the identity of the artist, but he may well have been Greek. On a more practical level, evidence of window glass has come to light at Pompeii, and it became relatively common in the later empire. To conclude, as Kevin Green has noted, if we have to pass judgment on ancient technology, then we need to decide whether we're judging it on A, the existence of technological inventions of considerable sophistication, or on B, how widely and productively technological inventions were employed. The Antikythera mechanism, for instance, though extremely sophisticated, may well have been one of its kind. In the next lecture, we're going to investigate another branch of Greek expertise where the Greco-Roman synthesis that we've examined in this lecture had even more important consequences for all those with the means to avail themselves of its benefits, namely medicine.